I want to make a statement. Yeah, I want to make a statement. Policy statement.
Go.
Let's see.
Everybody make
okay.
room.
Okay. Yeah, everybody stand back. Stand back. I gotta get a few things off my chest.
You sounded more like Trump.
A lot of accusations have been made about me. This is my National Press Club statement. A lot of accusations have been made about me and my team. Dr. Carolyn Dean, JW, and some nebulous ectoplasm called Ion. And anybody else that's associated with us. I'm speaking on behalf of our team. At this point, we interpolate an observation which is not only important to mastering all of the conceptions and included in this press conference as a whole, but also of probably considerable importance in guiding the reader and the listener to focus, and we have handed out the papers to everybody, but also of probably considerable importance in guiding the reader and listener to focus more surely the highly practical importance of the preceding unavoidably extended epistemological review in respect to grounding the more obviously more visibly practical political focus to which this is directed. Not only the proverbial man in the street, but also the overwhelming majority of the world's principal and other national political figures do not understand what are in fact the ABCs of how ION really works. Respecting the arts of statecraft, certain aspects of the techniques of the politician's craft, I could benefit from the knowledge, experience, and counsel to that effect for many professional political figures. Nonetheless, insofar as the processes underlying crucial political developments are concerned, the typical leading strata of national political figures and parties have yet no rigorous insight into the determining internal features of the overall Iondom process. This may be momentarily resented by some as what they regard for a moment as an insufferably arrogant statement of the matter by me. Even so, they dare not permanently brush my statement aside. Increasingly, most notably during the recent 3 years to date, key political strata of various factions of nations which presently include most of these of this world have, although for the most part begrudgingly, recognized some special quality, some active principle of unusual intellectual power behind the effectiveness of this special approach via Iondom to major topics of strategy and policy employed by me and my associates. Notably, respecting the most crucial issues of strategy and policy during the past 7 years, we have been overwhelmingly correct with respect to the contrary perceptions of leading forces of all notable factions within the United States, Western Europe, the developing sector, and Asian communist nations. This political situation is a typical problem of scientific progress. The growing curiosity, this reluctantly perceived fact of me and my colleagues' competence, has evoked among various leading circles, has in turn impelled significant portions of such strata, both here and abroad, into proposing or briefly adopting various wrong explanations concerning the nature of our political method and suspected special external sources of our unusual competencies. That's competencies. The following among those mistaken opinions are relevant to the broader practical point at hand here. The notion that an organization of such limited physical means, namely Iondom, could manifest repeatedly such striking confidence concerning vital issues of U.S. domestic and foreign policy was so insufferable in its implications to many leading strata that they more credulously accepted at one time or another the calculated slanders circulated chiefly through Andy Bob networks to the effect that our organization was... This is what they accuse us being, that Iondom was a front for variously the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, some groups of Chicago industrialists, the Soviet KGB, a group of third world governments, or at one point, among some Europeans, they thought we were extensions used by the papacy. The toleration of such disinformational explanations about where we come from and who's backing us was principally governed by their consoling features, so the toleration by us of these people and these explanations. was principally governed by their consoling features, that they appeared to explain away the disturbing fear that our competencies might be rooted in special internal qualities of our organization itself. They definitely did not want to think that we were competent on our own power. The notion that a small force of outsiders, an organization with no official, significantly institutionalized mandate to meddle in grand politics, could intrude hubristically, that's hubris, could intrude hubristically into the world's ruling circles and demonstrate that in the main, those circles lack some important competence. That was the crux of the matter, and of this matter. However, even the disinformational explanations in quotes, could not and did not live. There's been an overall increase in interest among various leading circles of the USA and abroad in acquainting themselves with our information on various matters of that sort. Such interest has ebbed and flowed repeatedly during the shorter term, but the fluctuations were only an included feature of a widening and otherwise significantly increasing overall tendency. The focus of such interest evolved over time, away from random patterns respecting specific topics and kinds of topics, to emphasize specific foci of information, including the varieties of background facts, analyses, and forecasts. The methodological error predominant, most emphatically, in the attempt to appraise Iandom's forecasts is the most efficient characterization of the wrong way our organization's qualities and its methods of work were generally appraised among leading and other circles. A forecast involves, in customary and mistaken opinion, a prediction. When what is offered is seen as a mere prediction, the recipient of such intelligence tends to assume that the source has either obtained vital information concerning the operational intent of the relevant agency involved in shaping the event, or that the projected conditions are deductively determined. Such appreciations applied to Bob's organizations and his output of intelligence ultimately involve precisely the same kind of error, otherwise prompting credulous acceptance of the sort of disinformation cited above. And this disinformation we're talking about is that we are a front for the KGB or third world governments or Chicago industrialists or the CIA or the papacy. In the matter of accepting consoling disinformation, in other words, these people can't handle our competencies, and they have to console themselves with this idea that we are extension of some other more formidable force. In the matter of accepting consoling disinformation, the credulous observer has fact that the subject organization's mind, Iandom, notable competencies arise autonomously from some special internal quality. That's what they deny. In the misinterpretation of the quality of the intelligence output we represent, the misinterpreter demands, in effect, that an unusual quality of competence be causally attributed to an ordinary sort of methodological practice. It is the methodological blunders commonly made in effort to interpret and assess Dobstown and Iandom's forecast, which is most to be singled out here, for sake of the urgent governing practical point under consideration in this policy statement as a whole. The exposure of what is badly mistaken in the cited two forms of misappreciation of our forecast points directly to that practical point. And that may be all I want to say at this point. All right? So, let me put on the record.
Is this your first policy statement?
In a way, we've been sitting around for 7 years taking the slings and arrows of misinformed judgment, and I'd finally had it, so I got back my old Secret Council 10 memos, looked them up, said, no, this is the kind of stuff I used to write 50, 60 years ago. So I got it out and made a new one to in this kind of diplomatic, bureaucratic language. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. It's a new kind of impact.
Yeah.
A new kind of effect.
Yes.
Old, very old and worn out bureaucratic language.
Yeah. Now, for some reason, the night we have no eye on, everybody and his dog is here. New names like Clara Curmudgeon. You're looking at this. Jack Surfay. Who are these people? Dilbert Dilly. Going on and on and on. Well,
and it's 4 a.m.
That kind of weekend,
time.
I guess. Yeah.
You only got an hour
okay.
left.
Okay.
Clara Curmudgeon.
Well, we don't have the protective aura of Ion. This degenerates into C. Kellen throwbacks. Now, look at Jay. He's quoting the case of Walter Lippmann. He took some of my words and put them in there, and he thinks he's figured out where I got them from. Well, that remains to be seen. The case of Walter Lippmann is a very good document that LaRouche put together in 1977. Now, on to the next point. Now, this is not a complaint. This is LaRouche stuff. So we're going to give you an example of what happens when you read LaRouche. What happens to your brain? Let's see, which is a good topic to start? Jay, remember I said I went back into my files to get documents. I think there might be some excerpts of the case of Walter Lippmann in this old document, but not all of it. My statement is made up of a collage of different sources of memos. Let's start off with this. This is pretty good. What is negentropy as opposed to entropy? LaRouche says things get better despite all the naysayers. Those that believe that society winds down, blows itself up, the universe, the sun eats up the solar system, that's all called entropy. But LaRouche says, no, it's negentropy, the constant improving, imperfecting of matter and human beings. So, he says, the characteristic feature of all living systems is negentropy. This feature of living processes is carried over in human development hylozoically. H-Y-L-O-Z-O-I-C-A-L-L-Y. So hylozoic. Let's look that word up so you can get a handle of what we're talking about here. Hylozoic. The philosophical doctrine holding that all matter has life, which is a property or derivative of matter. Holism is the philosophical point of view that matter is in some sense alive. Now, McLuhan, as a grammarian, says that language is alive. But one step back, the physicists, you say that matter is alive. And that's not generally accepted. But LaRouche seems to have that view. This feature of living processes is carried over in human development, hylozoically, in the form of the characteristic ordering principle of human willful behavior. This involves not only the potential negentropy embodied in abstract conceptions of technological innovations, but the tendency of each successful mode of human practice to produce a characteristic social surplus, a smaller or larger margin of product above what is required to replace the means of production and consumption consumed as actual or imputable costs in the course of producing the whole output. As Rosa Luxemburg, who I recommended her movie last week, as Rosa Luxemburg correctly emphasized in correcting Lenin's essential characteristic blunder in economic analysis, without social surplus, man would not have progressed beyond the stage of the Paleolithic scraper. All viable forms of human culture, in brackets technology, are characterized by thermodynamic negentropy in respect of the existence of a characteristic tendency for social surplus. In the positive self-subsisting process of self-expansion of that process involving the relationship of useful output to these inputs imputable as social costs of the production of that output. In other terminology, applying the notion of capitalist profit, in brackets industrial capitalist profit, retrospectively as an aid in preliminary description of previous modes of production, the existence of some form of profit as characteristic of the mode of production is the indispensable characteristic feature of all successful human modes of production and existence. The thermodynamic problem, which also exists in the more explicitly biological form in the necessarily negentropic ordering of the biosphere, is that the limits of a successful relatively fixed mode of production are not defined by an absolutely fixed mode of zero profit production, but by the fact that the rate of increase of the characteristic rate of profit becomes manifestly insufficient to keep pace with the increasing social cost of production arising from relative depletion of the existing set of technologically defined primary resources. So what I'm reading you is LaRouche's explanation of why you got to keep making new stuff, or you're just going to use up all your resources. So here's where LaRouche says those that interpret Marx as promoting the redistribution of wealth, that's going to go nowhere, because once it's all redistributed and everybody's having a good time and equally sharing the wealth, After a while, that wealth runs out, and nobody's qualified to make new wealth. So
now,
that's
Bob,
a good
is
criticism.
Is that different from the law of diminishing return?
Oh, that sounds good.
Okay. So there's always got to be something new to reach the
You have to
end.
Keep building. Ed. I don't expect you to understand anything that I said there in the details. This is the way LaRouche writes, very convoluted. But once you figure out what he's saying, it's easy to get. But you have to get the basics first to see what the hell he's leading to.
Yeah.
So I've been it's like Hugh Kenner, he was a famous Joycean critic. When he finally could read Ulysses and get the rhythms of it, it was a real aesthetic pleasure. Well, having read 11 LaRouche books, I finally got the rhythm. I know how to read and understand LaRouche's garble. And it's pretty interesting what he says. So he says, continuing, the limiting feature of societies is not that they fail to make some technological progress, but that the rate of technological progress fails to keep pace with the social cost effects of the depletion of the primary resources defined by existing technology. What therefore is required constantly is a higher rate of technological progress, to the effect that the extent of defined primary resources is increasing more rapidly than is being depleted in terms of previously dominant technology. The rate of profit, used in a specified way as a term of description, is the margin of energy available to the society to advance beyond practice in the existing technological forms. So you're talking about the existing situation, you got to go past that. Provided we employ technology in its broadest implications, as proper to and demanded by the case, the basis for defining the general principles required is established. The most apparent problem faced by societies is the problem of direction of utilization of this profit. If the profit is directed in its realization toward those forms of technological change which converge on a world line, and that's italicized, on a world line of increasing rates of negentropy in productive relations, then the problem of human existence can be solved within the framework of the institutions of that society. However, if the profit is diverted away from convergence upon that world line, the institutions which affect such a diversion thus direct the society toward its collapse. Basically, if you use profit to reinvest in the stock market and make more paper wealth, you're screwed. To the extent that one can approximate actual human history by the hypothetical case, the progress of humanity is represented by a special kind of world line. The first order characteristic of this world line is that it represents an optimal path of rising negentropy in respect to advancement of technology and an optimal, more rapid rate that mankind is exhausting. The first order characteristic of this world line is that it represents an optimal path of rising negentropy in respect to advancement of technology at an optimal, more rapid rate than mankind is exhausting primary resources and other pre-established productive resources as defined by previous technology. This world line does not depict something which happens miraculously. The mediating source of technological progress is the discovery, transmission, assimilation, and informing of the general impulses of willful social practice of both new scientific discoveries and the supplementary innovative potentialities subsumed by such discoveries. This mediation in all cases occurs through the creative mental powers and activity of human individuals. Hence, it is individual creativity, in brackets freedom, which is the active, immediate driving force represented by the world line. So here's his unique point. Freedom is the way you survive. It's not what people think freedom is. They do not think it's like saving the world kind of energy. Human creative mental powers have to be the driving force of this negentropic purpose, or you ain't free. Yet, the possibility of individual contribution depends upon education and also upon those other material and social circumstances which foster in individuals the power to create and to assimilate new conceptions going beyond the range of previously existing knowledge and related practice. Hence, the potential material and cultural conditions generated by technological progress represent the necessary preconditions for the individual creative initiatives which must be realized as the immediate ground source of technological progress. Thus, that hypothetical simplification of the actual ordering of our species history and prehistory represents, in fact, a self-subsisting positive universalizing principle. This principle is the unchanging principle, the characteristic causality in the succession of human technological and associated social progress. The principle itself is never altered. The principle of causality is unchanging. He's saying here, the medium is the message. Medium is technology. However, the success of societies determined by the action of this unchanging principle, unchanging causality, have different geometries. Just as feudal and capitalist society have different primary self-ordering characteristics in their appropriate geometric interpretation, it is possible, without exaggerating the argument by such resorts, to describe feudal society's imputable internal political economic geometry as epistemologically equivalent to the ordinary notions of field-particle relationships in Lagrangian or Maxwellian physics. And that's bad physics. LaRouche is going to get you to realize that field particle or figure ground is a limiting perspective. Whereas a society based on the humanist principles of industrial capitalism shared among Gresham, who lived in the 1400s, Bodin, 50 years later, Colbert, 1600s, Ben Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Carey, Karl Marx, these guys, they are developing industrial capitalism, and it is properly compared to the contrary features of higher order physical space as confronted in negentropic aspects of nonlinear plasma behaviors, as we shall show below. So he's saying the linear view ain't going to make it. You got to go to the nonlinear, and plasma physics seems to be a new discovery that fits that. And this was said, you know, almost 40 years ago. In the instance of Aristotelian or scholastic epistemology, we have the Euclidean form of Lagrangian physics implied geometry of society and technology embedded. For these cases, we have a priori notions of a linear metaphysical basis for space, time, and matter. In brackets, Euclidean space, time, and matter relationships, which are linear. Now, here comes an important paragraph. The most prominent feature and crucial empirical theoretical disqualification of Euclidean Aristotelian systems is that they deny the relevance of negentropic characteristics of reality, either by relegating the category of negentropic phenomena to the metaphysical or merely by excessively denying the evidence. The religious Aristotelian sets the negentropic evidence. Now listen to this. The religious Aristotelian sets the negentropic evidence considered into the category of the metaphysical outside the determined system. So here's the creation of the soul or some spiritual zone somewheres. They can't handle that being in the physical. Doesn't fit their system, so they got to say it's somewhere else. So thus, by such physical metaphysical dualism, the appearance of internal coherence of the physical system is defended. So they defend their fraudulent coherence by projecting something outside of this world. And it's called in the 19th century Elan Vital. New Age people are retrieving the Elan Vital. There's some extra spirit among us. The notion of Elan Vital, in brackets, although associated historically with degenerate nominalism's positive variant, parodies scholastic doctrine on this point. So the 19th century Elan Vital doctrine was an updating of this feudal idea. The evasion of the problem of scientific discovery is creative. Now here's where Ion comes in. The evasion of the problem of scientific discovery is creative synthetic content. Creative synthetic content is what we make through our words. The evasion of the problem of scientific discovery is creative synthetic content is similarly attempted by the doctrine of intuition. You know, all these people developing their intuition. Radical atheistic Euclidean Aristotelians evade the problem by the pathetic formulation, quote, that hypothesis is not necessary, unquote, saving the appearance of what they choose to regard as science by the shyster's ruse of canonically, like a canon, dogma, by the shyster's ruse of canonically outlawing all disagreeable empirical evidence from consideration within science rather than making it metaphysical. There is a direct correlation between the emergence of German critical philosophy during the 1780 to 1848 period and the French and German development of the preconditions for a relativistic physics, that's the good physics, according to LaRouche, the preconditions for a relativistic physics during the first half of the 19th century. The most prominent single intellectual influence for both currents of correlated development was Immanuel Kant. Kant, thus situated, serves as the most efficient reference point for interrelating the empirical and formal aspects of the notion of a negentropic relativistic physical space as it applies both to physics as such and to the distinct internal geometry of industrial, capitalist, and socialist development. Although industrial capitalists and socialist development have different geometries in respect to one another, they have coherent geometries and for the moment can be treated as subsumed within a common distinct class of geometries. Contrary to the various professedly neo-Kantian empiricists, these are bad guys, emerging inclusively around influences such as Friedrich Lang, Edward Bernstein, and others at the conclusion of the past century, 19th century, the conceptual breakthrough which defines Kant as the Kant was his sweeping refutation of British empiricism, or Aristotelianism, with immediate focus upon the provocative, objectionable, indifferentist thesis of David Hume. Kant's starting point for his comprehensive discrediting of British empiricism was the Aristotelian standpoint as inclusively formally typified by the physics of Lagrange. Also, the standpoint of Leibniz, I'll read that again. Kant's starting point for his comprehensive discrediting of British empiricism was the Aristotelian standpoint as inclusively formally typified by the physics of Lagrange. So Kant throws Lagrange to the garbage heap, and that was also the standpoint of Leibniz. Kant is getting near Leibniz. And the new view, a characteristic of the Enlightenment, up to the point of rejecting categorically the standpoint exemplified by Descartes and Spinoza. That is Kant's formal source of intellectual power and also his crippling defeat. Kant's achievement and power relative to most of his acknowledged principal predecessors was that he incorporated actively or virtually all the most relevant empirical evidence. His defeat was that he attempted, and was the last competent epistemological thinker to originate this approach, he attempted to fit all the evidence, including acknowledgement of the reality of man's creative synthetic powers respecting the realm of causally situated social practice, put a little note there, ion, acknowledgement of the reality of man's creative synthetic powers respecting the realm of causally situated social practice. He took all that stuff and tried to fit it back into the ultimately stretched limits of the Aristotelian Euclidean world outlook. Thus, accepting his correlated crippling categorical rejection of the alternative approach conveyed through Spinoza, Kant assembled and posed all of the principal immediate epistemological problems and thus described the fundamental problem of knowledge in the comprehensive form it could then be fruitfully attacked by his notable successors. The central, so everybody could use Kant as a jumping off point to bash the British, the City of London usurers, the monetarists. The central and for present purposes also most relevant feature of Kant's critiques is that he acknowledged the formal existence of a continuous principle of creative synthetic power in man, in human behavior, as characteristic of human behavior. I say that's what Ion's saying. I'll read that again. The central and for present purposes also most relevant feature of Kant's critiques is that he acknowledged the formal existence of a continuous principle of creative, in brackets, synthetic power in man, in human behavior, that's a characteristic of human behavior. This is what makes humans human. This was his stroke of genius relative to that time, the crux of his entire refutation of the British nominalist degeneracy typified by David Hume. Furthermore, Kant formally acknowledged the role of this characteristic feature of human thought as an efficient cause in the real universe through the instrument of informed impulses for willful practice. So there you have it. Efficient causality is what LaRouche is describing. The efficient causality implications of the medium is the message, whereas McLuhan does the formal causality implications. Now let's see. Yes?
Bob, just read that last
sentence. I finished my statement. Let me read that last bit.
Oh, now that's your conclusion. Okay, so that was the second part of your policy, your first policy statement.
No, this is not policy. That policy was put together by me on behalf of Eindem. I've been reading, the second thing, is from LaRouche,
okay,
his great document, The Case of Walter Lippmann, that Jay pointed out.
Oh.
And it's subtitled.
Oh, okay.
It's LaRouche's. This is LaRouche running for president. Talk about bureaucratic, incomprehensible stuff. It's called a presidential strategy.
But the last sentence...
This is presidential strategy.
The last sentence...
Yes, you want me to do it again?
Cause, yeah, efficient cause
yeah.
And real universe. Read that whole one. That whole
yeah.
Sentence.
Yeah. Furthermore, Kant formally... It's like formalistically formal. Kant formally acknowledge the role of this characteristic feature of human thought... In other words, what Ayn talks about our creativity, naturally, from our being,
yeah.
LaRouche sees it as an efficient cause in the real universe through the instrument of informed impulses for willful practice. Basically, you do it.
impulse.
Mm. I think I'll read another paragraph.
Practice.
Yes.
Well,
however, this central fact, these are big words for what Ion's saying. You know, he's telling you, get out there and do it. You do engage in willful practice.
You name it, you create it. It's
right.
And I want to go back and refresh myself on Platonism versus Aristotleism.
Plato is good. Aristotle's bad. Plato's always—he's not into categorizing things and making up encyclopedias. He's there, out there, working to the next development, the higher hypothesis to make better technologies and build cities. Whereas Aristotle is some guy sitting around categorizing everything and handing it over to his feudal aristocrat who makes sure the peasants remain stupid and plowing the fields.
That's exactly it. Earlier this evening, you and Andrew were talking, and you were explaining that, you know, there's like two factions, and one wants to keep everybody stupid and stifled in their creativity, and another wants to encourage and support creativity of the masses. Do you remember?
Right. Now, Andrew, who would be Andrew? Who's Andrew?
I'm sorry, Brian. Brian.
Brian.
Oh, yeah, Brian Taylor, yes. Yeah, not Andrew.
Yeah. I was thinking of Andrew.
Yeah, that's the simple. See, that's the simple interpretation. And so practicing ascending with this mortar stuff, so you take that simple point. It's interesting to read articles by his followers. They make it real simple. They can't go into this philosophical babble that he can do. They can't do it. They're not trained. Their minds aren't that specialist. But it's interesting, once you understand what he's saying, his distinctions are important. Make very subtle distinctions between things. So, for example, he says, however, this, what I just read you, that last sentence, and it goes in the next paragraph. However, this central fact, which properly led to the formal repudiation of the entire Euclidean Aristotelian system, that was then arbitrarily confined within the general Aristotelian Euclidean epistemological basis with the aid of two complementary ruses. So this was Kant's mistake. He kicked it out, but then he thought he had to adapt himself to that. The establishment was still there. First, Kant fitted the creative principle, the Ionic principle, into the system he was attempting to repair and save by locating the origin of the creative synthetic principle as an additional a priori quality of the Aristotelian Euclidean basis. That was a mistake.
And that's,
second, he attempted to save the notion of Aristotelian... What?
That's the do-gooders in government, Bob. People go into government to fix it from the inside.
Right. Second, he attempted to save the notion of Aristotelian Euclidean determinism, ultimately by a redirecting of the same ruse employed in the late 15th century by Marcilio Ficino's Five Questions, something he wrote called Five Questions. Acknowledging that the efficiency of creative knowledge for practice invalidated axiomatically the Aristotelian Euclidean ontology, in other words, this Ionic principle invalidated all the other guys, Kant created the empty, he was acknowledging the efficiency of this, he created the empty construct of an unknowable thing in itself as the ultimate reality underlying the relatively false, knowable, phenomenal thing. Thus, he saved the Aristotelian Euclidean system. What?
Say that again. The unknowable thing.
There's this phrase, thing, the thing in itself. That's a Kantian term. It's always talking about the thing in itself. So, he created the empty construct of an unknowable thing in itself as the ultimate reality underlying the relatively false, knowable, phenomenal thing. So Kant sort of gets the LaRouche idea, the Ionic idea, but he says we can't know it. LaRouche says we can know it and do something with it. Thus, Kant saved the Aristotelian Euclidean system in respect to the knowable. Then, on the basis of this metaphysical trick, albeit an epistemologically rigorous trick of almost unprecedented intellectual force, Kant proved, formerly by means of the postulated unknowable domain of the thing in itself, a constant state of non-aesthetic space-time in which unknowable infinity, the universalizing and ultimate implications of efficient creative practice, were resolved in an incomprehensible state which must be conceived of aesthetically as comparable to a state of the universe as if at rest. And then the first major intellect to attempt to solve this fallacy of Immanuel Kant directly with respect to physics as such is Riemann. And Riemann is LaRouche's hero.
Oh,
Riemann. So then I'll wrap up with this point. He says, Ryman makes this explicit through his purportedly metaphysical commentaries on the Kantian Herbart, this Kantian follower. So the Pinks say that Ryman goes metaphysical. And LaRouche is going to say no. It is traditional among commentators on Ryman to pretend they are unfamiliar with these metaphysical commentaries or to pretend that such material has no direct relevance for Ryman's other work as a mathematical physicist. However, as a rigorous consideration of the notion of self-expanding n-dimensional manifold, what it requires, I'll read that again. However, as a rigorous consideration of the notion of a self-expanding n-dimensional manifold requires, especially with the aid of light respectively contributed by Cantor, requires these metaphysical gropings of Ryman. Coming to lab, blowing it on the last sentence. How's that for life? Within key to the unphysical. Try to figure out where the word requires, however.
Go back to the self-unfolding n-dimensional something.
Yeah, just a second. Right, so what's required? However, as a rigorous consideration of the notion of a self-expanding n-dimensional manifold requires these metaphysical gropings of Riemann's. Especially with the aid of light. That's a misprint. Anyway, just joke. Especially with the aid of light, retrospectively, these requires these metaphysical gropings are coherent. However, as a reason, so all this stuff is coherent with and key to the underpinnings of the greatest single physicist discovery of the past two centuries. So Riemann is the greatest single physicist. His discovery, what is coherent with it, is the rigorous consideration of the notion of a self-expanding n-dimensional manifold. Oh, wait, here's how you do it. Okay. So requires is the end of it. However, as a rigorous consideration of the notion of a self-expanding n-dimensional manifold requires, in other words, this manifold requires this rigorous consideration, especially with the aid of light retrospectively contributed by Cantor. So as this thing requires this rigorous consideration, these metaphysical gropings, these things that people think are just Ryman going metaphysical, are coherent with and key to the underpinnings of the greatest single physicist discovery of the past two centuries. So they're saying this stuff that they categorize as metaphysical is very important to this physical mathematical work. That's what he's saying there. So what's interesting is that LaRouche says that science cannot be objective. There's a big subjective factor. So because LaRouche brings in this sort of humanist aspect of we create our rules and laws, which are projections of ourselves, not in the New Age sense, a woo-woo sense, but you must acknowledge the subjectivity. Therefore, empiricism or regular science, which makes these objective laws and that's it, is limited because it doesn't include the making, the interplay, the adjusting by the subject, by the person in the scientific unfoldment.
Yeah, the scientific method itself creates a subjective environment.
Yeah.
Well, in reaction, it creates romanticism. If you don't include, if you're claiming you got this universal law that's heteronomic, which means you're inside its prison, you're imposed upon by this law, then the human gets uptight about this, gets remorseful, melancholy, and starts smoking dope, right? Because the objectivity.
Bob, we should know again if our creativity was not stifled, we would already know all of the physics that. You know, has that Sarfati has explored for the last 50 years. And if we, like...
No, we wouldn't know it. You don't just know. That's intuition. We're not talking about intuition. We're disagreeing with the language you're buying on.
Another way to say it is I don't even have a concept of what it's like to exist as a human without the idea of romanticism having been already placed on my culture. You know, I can't.
Yes, you must have romantic. That's why Zappa said he didn't like love songs. They made people unrealistic.
So I think if the physics has had been incorporated into our educational system, we'd have an entirely different perspective of our existence.
It is incorporated, but it's the Aristotelian Euclidean wrong kind of physics. Now here's where LaRouche is being he's being very strict about what should be done. But what should be done is not the normal dogmatic stuff. He's saying let everybody participate. Let people make their discoveries. Let them retrace the previous discoveries. It takes time to do this. You got to do the work. But he's not trying to. He says the rigid image of science is not applicable to what's happening. Now this sounds exactly the way Ion presents science.
Yeah.
Do not become a stick in the mud about it, because as Lou says, it's always going to be upset by newer technologies, newer breakthroughs. So you don't get fanatic about what you think you know at this point. It's not the end point. So this idea that Riemann is doing metaphysical commentaries, LaRouche calls this the Sunday supplement representation of his ideas. You know, a newspaper journalistic Sunday supplement puff piece. So he says the Sunday supplement representation of so-called non-Euclidean geometries, they're thinking that Riemann is a non-Euclidean geometry, this representation centers around a discussion of the parallel axiom and hereditary features of the Euclidean system and compares Gauss, Lobachevsky, Bolyai, and Riemann from that standpoint. If such discussion is intended to imply that a relativistic physics, and that's a good physics, involves a non-Euclidean geometry in that sense, then the discussion is nonsensical. Any non-Euclidean geometry based upon such simple formal alterations of the axiomatic premises of a Euclidean geometry carries forward all the hereditary defects which prevent the Euclidean system itself from providing the conceptual form or basis for a truly relativistic physics, or from successfully delineating the characteristics of the geometry of an actual Riemannian relativistic physics. Now, I'm not saying you don't know what I'm talking about. You can't understand this. It's too fast and it's too complicated. But I'm saying part of ascension is being able to understand this whack job. It actually makes sense once you get into it, you know. But it takes a while to figure out what it's doing. So
it made me think, Bob, acknowledge creative synthetic man. I happened across Andrew Crystal talking to Ion, and I don't know what the date was. It was in Studio A sometime this week. And Andrew was having a discussion with Ion about avatars, about that concept of us being avatars. And the creative synthetic man reminds me of that concept of we're expressing our creativity in a synthetic environment that we created in the first place.
That sounds rather subjective to me. I don't know what you're talking about, but that's okay. That's your working out your language.
Yeah, synthetic. The idea of holographic.
Virtual.
Yes.
Well, all technology is synthetic. It's new nature. It's adding to the old kind of nature.
Yes.
Now, here we talk about figure ground, but figure ground is a field particle, the particle and the field relationship. LaRouche is describing the incompetence of the figure ground view. And he's actually correct, because to look at the figure and then see the ground is visual bias. That's what the eye sees. The eye puts something in a framework. You got the figure and then you got the frame or ground.
Yep.
So to see through that, to see what McLuhan's talking about beyond that is can be helped by understanding LaRouche. I think we're going to end at the top of the hour, so 23 minutes. So I think I'm going to read some more garble just to finish this section.
Well, let me ask you one more question about that.
Yeah.
About in other words, I'm still creating the image. I still am basing things on an image I'm creating. Based on a visual bias, my visual bias.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
In a sense, you have a figure and then a frame or a ground, a particle and a field. The pre-visual and post-visual person doesn't see something in a framework or in a background. Figure is in front, background is ground. They see each thing creating its own space. There's no common universal platform that the figures are running around on. So LaRouche says there's a universal aspect. Like Ion would say, there's no universality.
Okay, so in a way, to organize it still. I'm still trying to organize.
Yeah, no, that's okay. But LaRouche refines your organizing by bringing in a tactile acoustic level. So there's a universal law in nature, but it's not something you write on the blackboard and memorize. There's a universalizing tendency. So he's taking the printing press made you have a visual bias of the universal. LaRouche is trying to go beyond the visual bias and create a new kind of visuality or new kind of universality, which is pretty hard to get. But I just want to read maybe what.
That sounds like what you just spoke of made me think of what I recall from LaRouche's essay from Mathematics, Not Science. He was talking about Kepler, that he was refuting the sense certainty of what mathematics creates, like what McLuhan says, a visual bias.
Right. And then you have LaRouche saying that poetry is more important than any mathematical law. Because poetry leaves it open.
Yeah.
Poetry is an ambivalent use of language or creates ambiguity. And it gets the mind used to that. So it's very interesting. So LaRouche is not talking about the effects of technology on people. That's what McLuhan's doing. But LaRouche is, as an inventor, making machines, is talking about the efficient causality and showing this non-visual element to it, to the process of making something.
Wow.
So it's... he's got himself in a weird state of mind, and it's interesting to figure it out.
And it takes you to explain it for me to even attempt to look at it that way.
Yeah, nobody. If you don't have my explanation, you won't read this.
Yeah, I would remain rigid in my frame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now let's see what Jay is saying. There's all kinds of good stuff. These people keep typing. It's sort of relevant, but we can't address you. You guys should phone in. We can address speech easier than typing. Two-jewel snort spoon. This might be all the same person. The spooks wanted computers to break all codes. Laughing out loud. The thing that breaks codes breaks the need for secrets. Yeah, it's an interesting thought. Platonic solids are digitizations or Platonic solids are digitizations or volume estimates of a sphere using endpoints of equally spaced distribution. Very interesting, but why don't you come on and talk about it? Because we have to pick apart what you mean by each phrase. You're just making you're being Aristotelian by laying out a bunch of words. That we're supposed to say, yeah, that's it. No more research necessary. We got it. The ultimate fucking sentence has been written. So we're not going to engage that stuff. So come on in. Jax or Fatty? Jax R. Fatty. Phatty. Check the numbers, Bob. He's talking about, it's all 113. That 113's been around for a long time, right? I don't know if he's talking about his code name. Who's 113? It's been here a long time. I've seen 113 often.
58 is familiar, too.
Yeah, .113 is posted for weeks without any name in front of it. Now he's got Jax or Fatty. He says, use your Googler. About what? About what you're quoting? Yeah. He says, McLuhan is fairly adamant that people working in high-level physics are actually more auditory since they move away from sequencing thing in time when they enter Q50. That's true. The physicists are trying to visualize non-visual phenomena, and the ones with the acoustic bias have a little bit extra advantage to it. He says, nah, it used to be 230. Well, I never followed the numbers too much. You know who 230 was?
No.
Gene?
Ora.
O-R-A, okay.
O space R-A.
Anyway, don't be paranoid. Call in and participate.
I don't have a 113 or a 58.
Yeah. We're not interested in reading shit. Look, somebody's pointing out that SyncBook, where me and Roxy are on SyncBook, does a lot with Native Land. Somebody goes, did Bob just mention Native Land? Anyways, I don't know if I have time. I wonder if I should read this part. Nah. The point is, you know, I can read stuff that you can't understand. I think I made my suggestion that it won't hurt you to sort of look at LaRouche's talks, because I can get in it and find that he is pointing to ionic points to the degree ion has any points. It's interesting how it fits, because he's not doing regular science. He's made up his own weird mixture of poetry, economics, physics,
yes,
math, and weaponry.
Yes.
Bob, what's the title of the essay you're reading?
This is a doc. It's a big thing, big paperback, but big size, and it's called "The Case of Walter Lippmann," Lippmann. The subtitle: "A Presidential Strategy" by Lyndon Lace LaRouche Jr. And his company published it in 1977. But, you know, here you have this mathematical physics and all kinds of different topics. The first sentence in the thing begins with, guess what? The early American poet and novelist Edgar Allan Poe related a tale of a man hypnotized at the moment of his death, whose mind remained active while the dead body to which it was pinioned underwent the progress of decay. The smell of that grisly Edgar Allan Poe tale erupts as an association, as one compares the 1944 U.S. foreign policy and U.S. war aims of Roosevelt's Fabian propagandist Walter Lippmann to, if you compare his report, to the decay-stricken effluvia of today's Trilateral Commission and its fellow accomplices. Beginning shortly after his 1914 screening and indoctrination under the Fabian Sidney and his wife, the Webbs in England, do that again. Beginning shortly after his 1914 screening and indoctrination under the Webbs in England, the Webbs were close to Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells, Lippmann emerged to become for over almost half a century a leading Fabian political propagandist. He was an intimate of both British political intelligence and Woodrow Wilson's confidential circles during the period of the Versailles Treaty. That's 1919-1920. He was an outsider during the 1920s Republican administration periods. He, though, regained his semi-official status in relationship to the Roosevelt administration. He was a major advisor to Roosevelt, and apparently he coined the phrase the Cold War. And he later drifted into the rank of elder statements of the Anglo-American political intelligence circles. This book, written in 1944. At the time it was written and published, Lippmann's cited book had an important assigned role in the process of formulating post-war U.S. policy. Although the Rockefeller's Brookings Institution had already articulated the main premises of the proposed policy in the American Century, in quotes, American Century Doctrine, issued some years earlier, that general doctrine had not been elaborated in terms appropriate to the principal strategic relations emerging from the course of World War II developments. The years 1943 and 1944, the years the material in the book was first published, were the aftermath of a series of policy-setting negotiations among Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, notably including the Tehran Agreement in Iran. Churchill and Roosevelt were satisfied that they had brought Stalin to terms to the point that the basic lines of Anglo-American foreign policy could be defined for decades ahead with a large measure of certainty before him. Something more substantial than Woodrow Wilson's swindles, such as the sententious hypocrisy of the so-called Atlantic Charter, something more than that was wanted. Moreover, President Roosevelt, at the acme of his political influence over the U.S. electorate, was dying. the powers associated with Roosevelt, including notably John D. Rockefeller II and his sons, that would be the five sons, Nelson, David, John, Winthrop, and Lawrence. The powers associated with Roosevelt, including notably John D. Rockefeller II and his sons, urgently needed to have Roosevelt run for one more term, which he would not live out, so that they might use the Roosevelt charisma to commit the USA and other nations to a more specific version of that American century doctrine through which the Rockefellers and their associates proposed to establish an indefinite future period of increasing domination over the entire world. The 1943-1944 period of preparation for Roosevelt's last election campaign was the crucial period of the big selling job. To use that campaign to impose upon the U.S. government and electorate's conscience that policy of intended Rockefeller world rule. Lippmann, then at the peak of his public influence, was the key Fabian publicist in the effort to indoctrinate the nation's editorial writers and others with the new elaboration of the American century doctrine. In that connection, Lippmann contributed more than marginally to the shaping of that policy into the forms deemed politically digestible to the credulous. The book in question thus represents one of the more important pieces of Atlanticist political campaign literature of the present century. So LaRouche, you know, 30 years later, is going back and looking at the role of that document, then showing how the Kennedy administration, the Carter administration, repeated it. And now we're headed for a nuclear war, World War III. Says LaRouche in 77. But that was the year Bob showed up at the McLuhan Center and started to act a little more publicly. So what did we do? What was the first intervention I did? We're talking about 1984. Yeah, so this is a period 7 years before 1984, the 1977 intervention of Bob into Toronto after furtive secretive encounters with McLuhan for the last 15 years before 77. Indicated some of them in the diaries. So, happy to lay out a bit of the past and how it was set up from my future to your present. So, Gene, you can get the whole book online?
It looks like it, but it's in the software that's a little hard to read and turn the pages. I was trying to find where you were at.
Oh yeah, look, there it is. Yeah, there's the some of the pages. So you scroll down. How do you get to the next page?
Bottom right
corner.
What
do you click on? Oh, the
bottom
arrow?
Right corner, there's arrows.
Oh yeah, there it is, yeah. Oh yeah, well there it is. So there it is, guys. You can read what I'm trying to read.
Okay.
And the pictures. There's
Yeah, the pictures are interesting. Can you make that larger? Yeah, you can make
it
bigger.
Yeah, there's that magnifying glass, but then it gets really big for me, and then it's kind of hard to move around. And
yeah, it gets too big, so it's not user-friendly. But
it's
try reading that fucking thing. I mean, I'm reading it. I read books that he did in 79-80, and into 79-80-81. And then I go back and read this, which was written a few years before his books. I understand where this is going, because I read the later books. So then the later books are like slightly simplifications of the details of this thing. I mean, I'm only on page 80-something. You know, it's going to take a long time to finish this.
I'm looking at, there's a chapter called The Three Atlanticist World Wars.
And yeah.
The first paragraph, he's basically calling the Third World War on the track toward a general thermonuclear war as early as 1977.
Right.
And
so he's writing this in late 76. And that's exactly, now what's amazing is he quotes General Brown, and that's who Dr. Beter was visiting in the Pentagon the same year in 1976 and trying to stop the nuclear war. There was some panic going on behind the scenes that Beter goes into more details than LaRouche could or knows.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. Beter had this friend, General Brown, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and LaRouche is up on it and comments on what Brown said in late 76. So it's also interesting how
that's
you get
the
this
one
overlap
where they denied it
between McLuhan, Beter. Listen. You get this overlap. You get twinges of McLuhan in there, twinges of Mae Brussels, twinges of beater. That's what I find interesting. So what were we saying, Gene?
That was when he talked to General Brown, and then Brown denied it or dismissed it, and then Brown called him in later for more information.
Yes. And then he got more information, and he supported it, and then he got fired, I think. He got too involved with fringe guys like Beater. Now here's James saying, Bob has laid out more learning materials within 7 years live on radio than any professor could do in his entire stinky career.
It's true.
And 2 Jules Snortspoon says, praise Bob, praise Bob. Yeah, that's right. Endless, this is the new university, Jay, and I assume that's James, what's his last name? Poothis, forget his last name.
Poustier.
Yes, he's been so Poustier. Absent. Poustier or something. And then Jay says, just the facts. That's right. So I'm now going to type the bill. Ending, what do you call it? End at 11. Part 1 of the April 22nd weekend marathon of non-ionic bullshit. Ending at this hour. Bill. Anyways, this now, me reading LaRouche, as we saw Ion say a couple weeks ago, I've caused a fucking wrinkle in the fabric of the universe. The universe says, what the fuck? This is too violent of a retrieval, Bob. We didn't think LaRouche had anything to say. We've moved beyond LaRouche. Why are you going back?
You said Ion was upset. That's right.
Yeah. Says you've put a wrinkle in the fabric, and you've caught a sidebar that's going to take years to recover from, Bob. I even got Carolyn reading LaRouche.
Oh, I'm pretty fascinated about the Reconstruction talk and how Ion described the subcultures of that period. That's
right.
That's pretty interesting.
Well, did we talk about how the TV show Occupy, made in Norway?
Yes, I watched that,
yes.
Bob.
They show. So Bill's saying, going to restart. We're going to restart at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll say the same each week for now. Right. So I don't know if anybody will come back. Not likely to be any Ion. So what are we going to do? Oh, I have to play my shit, man. I didn't play my stuff.
Ion session.
You're going to have to come back. You guys say, fuck that. I can just hear it in the archives. You never know.
Oh, of course. I love the 5-hour nap. Then we're all refreshed and you're refreshed.
Yeah.
You just go watch TV, but we all come back refreshed.
That's right. I don't nap. No napping here. Always on duty.
Well, when I get to 90,
I did all this, Bert. What'd you say? You won't do it either?
When I get to age 90, I won't nap either.
Yes. Don't blame it on our senility. It's not. I'm not like this because I'm senile. But anyways, Bert, you said you were reading LaRouche. We did all this for you. We showed you where expert LaRouches go. You're just a toddler, a neophyte. But this is where you're heading. Look at that. Jackson, he says you got to play some ELO. I know somebody recommended ELO. That was Ra-Ra-Ra, who could be R-A. Yes, I'm sorry. Well, we'll do that and maybe...
Talk about Occupy at some point.
Any thoughts on the work of the late John Keel? Yes, I met John Keel in a little place in New York in 2005 in an apartment of a publisher of fringe books, alternative books, and he just kept to himself. He wouldn't talk much. He was old, maybe bored with everybody. But, he discovered the Mothman prophecies or something. But it's all trivial. Any of those topics are tiny compared to the depth we do with ion. You know, you just can't compare. That's 20th century stuff. Now, Jay says, well played, Bob. What the hell are you talking about, Jay? What's well played? And then you say the work of Douglas Dietrich. Mentioned that a few weeks ago to me. Look, I'm not impressed unless they include Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan and all things I include. They're just fucking specialists. Focus on one little theme. Not impressed with anybody anymore. They're hard enough for me to pay attention to ION. I'm impressed with me.
Well, you just gave another clear example of just when you think you're grasping a part of it, you got to break that apart and look at it an entirely different way because,
yeah,
you know, I'm still locked in to that mode of processing.
Right. We're not trying to be aimless anarchists. It's actually learning how to think, get a pattern, let it go. Get a new pattern, then retrieve the one you let go, and then flip it, and then find a whole new pattern you never expected.
Enjoying the attempt
play.
To not persuade others, Bob.
Yes, and LaRouche gave me permission. One of the little things I read, he said, and also have the right to try to convince others of what you are excited about.
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you're the only one that should attempt to persuade others at this point.
Yes, I'm qualified. I'm the black belt of explanation. Wait, say that, Jay. Jay says, well played, Bob. Well, which game did I play? What? Which part? I said many things, James. Here we go. Another 6 seconds, and then come old Dave Neufeld intro, outro.
Good night.
Bang.